This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Jan Bartlett. I'll be here until 6 tonight. Today I'm speaking with Palestinian from Jenin, Amin Abbas, about the situation as we approach the second anniversary of the breakout from Gaza. Professor Richard Tanter, talking about the time when an Australian Prime Minister showed he had backbone and stood up to the United States over nuclear issues. Dr. Helen Rosenbaum from the Deep Sea Mining Campaign, analysing the Four Corners program recently on deep sea mining. Activist and writer Fred Fuentes on the jailing of Bolsonaro in Brazil. The second part of the history of Costa Rica with Dr. Sasha Gillies-Lakakis, and of course, Mr. Kevin Healy with his week that was.
A week, Jane Lister, when it got off to a discouraging start. P1 kicker Albing Uzi seeks to reset ties with business, then big headline, Supremo's call to get behind climate plan. Big Supremo Anthony Albing Uzi will call for corporate Trublowazi to back the socialist climate change agenda. Oh God, I thought, more bad news for the environment. Anthony was addressing the Trublowazi Business Profits Council's annual meeting, attempting, the Trublowazi Capitalist Review reported on behalf of the filthy rich, to reset a fraught relationship with big business. See, he needs a reset because he's so upset the caring business class with outrageous caring business class relations changes, which, as the Capitalist Review pointed out, had disadvantaged poor caring employers. Industry-wide bargaining, same work, same pay, cracking down on labour hire routes, even criticising the supermarket duopoly for, quote, inappropriate profiting, as if. Oh, it's an endless litany of national injury against the great creators of wealth, even proposals that might, at their extreme, force the poor dears to pay some tax. On which the Business Profits Council made it clear to Anthony that a proposed tax on corporate cash flows affecting the 500 or so largest companies is not on, will stifle already anemic business investment. The tax, it said, was uncompetitive and ill-conceived. We need to close down that conversation as quickly as possible. How could the government be so naive, so myopic, not to see the anti-Trublowazi consequences of trying to squeeze some taxes from the filthy rich? Anemic business investment, that's what. Although a fuller explanation of how paying tax is uncompetitive mightn't have hurt. And after creating all that damage, Anthony wants to stop polluting or, well, support the government's pollution address climate change policy. What a cheek. Between the socialist transition through fossil approval policy and the caring business class, the environment's certainly in safe hands. Yet, we commented last week how cruel these long-haired, commie, greeny, wooden working and iron environmentalists can be, that Bob Brown throwing outrageous barbs at our Minister for Environmental Pollution, Murray Swatch, the environment, this week, bloody Greenpeace stepped in, claiming BCE, the Business Profits Council, BCE stands for Blocking Climate Action. The Business Profits Council report paves the way for a weak target, more new gas, and would see climate pollution soar, it raved. How dare they attack Anthony's chosen partner in saving the planet? And as if the poor supermarket duopoly hasn't got enough to worry about with ludicrous suggestions they are ripping off, the federal court has hit them with a $1 billion bill for underpaying workers. This after Kills Value was already paid $31 million after being sprung, and Woolworths' trillions a whopping $486 million. Being sprung an unfair slight, because it's all inadvertent, of course, which is a hell of a lot of inadvertent. Those awards must be so complicated, mustn't they, that they totally bemuse the duopoly accountants, whom we assume are not totally financial and grammatical illiterates. The attacks get worse. The out-of-control federal court again. the poor big troubler was he. BHP, bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, forced to pay its in-house labour hire workers the same pay as its other workers just because they're all doing the same job, a $30 million pay rise. Doesn't the federal court have any concern for BHP shareholders? And we know there must be a simple reason. But until bloody huge explains it, we're left to believe, as we've said a number of times, that the only explanation for the 30 mil is that bloody huge has been ripping off its labour hire workers to the tune of, well, obviously, 30 mil. Amazing, given that obvious difficulty in comprehending awards, that caring employers never manage to overpay workers inadvertently. One would think on the law of averages, but no. And huge construction conglomerates were also accused of ripping off workers, assaulting and intimidating an evil union official, underpayment, sham contracting, a long list. So obviously, the socialists will immediately take them over and appoint an administrator to run them. Thank goodness through all this, a true socialist emerged. That unflinching champion of workers, former ACTU Secretary Little Billy Kiltbem, proud player in giving us economic rationalism, announcing his resignation from his post-ACTU working class struggle after 26 years as a director of Lynn Foxy, run by his very, very close filthy rich of the filthy rich friend, Lindsay Foxy. I just saw it doing the same thing I've always believed in, trying to improve the living standards of ordinary troubler Aussies. I have a broad view of being a socialist, in that you don't leave people behind, but in order to produce the best results, you can work with good companies. You can use profitability to improve living standards. Oh, Little Billy, spoken like a true socialist. Good companies. Surely an oxymoron, and profitability are the very stuff of socialism. Still, they explain a fair bit about Little Billy, albeit nothing we didn't know, and he was spot on in one area, a broad view of being a socialist. A not-so-broad view of what's required to make a great society, make America great again, provided to US of the UN of the US of the world, make America great again youth by Charlie Carktit, who told his deep-thinking audience gun deaths were worth it as the price of liberty, of freedom, of saving the US from abortion and trans threats and evil unions and anti-Zion protesters. Oh, a litany of threats to liberty, freedom and democracy. And, well, therefore, Charlie can't complain. Not that he can now, but he's carked it. His hero, big Supremo Donald Trump of the poor, decried, radical left political violence, the biggest radical left political violence ever, ever. Unlike non-radical right political violence, which is pro-liberty, freedom and democracy, essential to the freedoms threatened by the violent, violent commie left. Back here, the parliamentary democratic process also suffered a devastating blow when that champion of multicultural harmony, Jacinta Auntie Thomasina Price, paid the price, was shuffled from her junior shadowy assistant ministry to the back bench, which is bound to shut her up, just because in attacking the socialists for something they hadn't done, silly Jacinta, when there's so much we can attack them for, hadn't done, insulted the second biggest population on the planet, smart political move. And Jacinta knows hate means never having to say you're sorry. The great US of pioneers knew how to handle their Indian problem, she bemoaned, displaying her unswerving commitment to the cause of First Peoples. On which, how the terra nullius non-land non-people must wish they had adopted a no proper papers queue-jumping illegal boat people policy 227 years ago. Then the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin wouldn't have been forced to run a double-page spread warning us about this treaty the state socialists have struck with the terra nullius non-land non-people. Sweeping powers as critics demand the deal should be put to a referendum. So dire that in a double-page spread and subsequent spreads, the poor old Wapping Sin couldn't find one person who thought it might be a good idea. why these Terranilius non-land, non-people could start acting like they own the place. Reported last week, the AN0FU bank accidentally informed staff they were for the chop. Sorry, sadly having to be let go when some idiot pressed the wrong button and, oops, return your computer appeared on the workers' screens. Well, this week, new bank supremo Nuno Mates I'm Not said 3,500 jobs will go, which he said had nothing to do with profit. They've announced a record profit, and nothing to do with AI or technology. In fact, nothing to do with anything, apparently. That's not quite true, Nuno corrected us. Then what? Fear! But in an inspired human relations move described by the Troop Lawazi Capitalist Review as the Hunger Games AN0FU style, some threatened sadly let go can save their jobs. See, for every 10 remaining positions, they invite about 30 workers to apply, of whom 20 will then hand in their computers. And the bank's general counsel, whose job we assume is not under threat, said, our objective is to treat everyone with dignity and respect. Not sure we need to comment on that. Yet, despite all that sincerity, the bloody evil union, as usual, did comment, questioning the dignity and respect bit. But Nuno took a break from sadly having to let go to address a big business Asia summit, lecturing us that Troubler was he needs to posit itself as a beacon for talent, presumably exercising that talent down at the local Centrelink office. Oh, and an update from our international desk. As we record this, the latest in the conga line of French PM, Sébastien Lecornu, appointed on Wednesday, was still ensconced after a record 6 days in the job. And finally, top marks to the US for commemorating 9/11, finally admitting its role, along with our very own ASIS, in delivering years of pinch-of-shit terror to the Chilean people on that date in 1973. Good afternoon.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
The focus of the program now is Gaza, where the genocidal actions of the Zionist government of Israel continue unabated. I'm speaking with Palestinian activist Amin Abbas and ask you, Amin, do you still have contacts in Gaza at this time?
Yes, we do.
Can you talk about what they're saying to you?
Okay, so obviously the situation in Gaza has been extremely horrific. It's probably been the worst it has been since the beginning of this onslaught. The more recent challenge that we have is that Gaza City, in particular, where a lot of people that were displaced multiple times throughout the war, including from Gaza City, in the most part, a big portion stayed in Gaza City and some returned from their displaced areas to Gaza City. And now the Israeli army seems to be quite intent on reducing it to rubble, similar to what we've done in other places like Rafah, for example. So the situation has been as worse as it has ever been. And more recently, there's been evacuation orders for all of Gaza City. And just to kind of like get maybe the listeners to understand why this is significant, because Gaza City is really the most important part of Gaza. This is where the universities, the hospitals, the orphanage partners that we actually have at Amal are actually in Gaza City. So this is like telling the people of Melbourne or Sydney CBD to evacuate and go elsewhere. And obviously, the comparisons are really different because Gaza itself is so tiny and so small. All of Gaza can probably fit in a subset of those CBDs. So it's really a very challenging situation, particularly when we're talking about a million people that are expected to just, you know, leave everything and get displaced, as all their houses and institutions are actually reduced to rubble. So it's extremely horrific, because also a lot of those people have nowhere to go, because the rest of Gaza also has been not safe at all. So this idea of safe passages do not exist, let alone the fact that what we're talking about here is the idea of really a concentration camp within certain areas in Gaza. And by the way, the term concentration camp could be triggering for some people, but by the way, this is what the Israelis themselves are actually using in their mainstream media. The idea that we are creating concentration camps for Palestinians in Gaza. The reality is we actually are talking about the genocide being so blunt in Gaza City today, and all our partners are really struggling. You're talking about the people themselves that are responsible for children. They're really through their own survival for themselves and their own families. So we're talking about people that are trying to do what they can to help others, when in fact they themselves are the victims, of these policies of the Israeli government.
Is there evidence that they are already building these concentration camps and where they are?
There definitely are, a lot of those points that the Israeli army are pointing people to go to, that are in the most part tents. Some of those are close to the coast in certain areas that are, being directed by the Israeli army. Some of those are also like close to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. Again, those are death traps in the most part. Like, you know, you're talking about many hundreds of Palestinians that have been shot and killed as they are queuing up to get food. So we are talking about trying to push as many of those Palestinians to certain locations. And Jenna, I'm sure a lot of the listeners do understand that the purpose of Israel in Gaza has not really been about the hostages. If they wanted to get the hostages out, they probably would have negotiated and then got something done in maybe October 9th, I think what was when they were offered the hostages if the war stops. But that's not really the intention. The intention is really get rid of as many Palestinians as possible from Gaza. As it is also the case from the West Bank, they ideally want as much of the geography with as least possible from the perspective of the demography. They don't want the Palestinians there. And by the way, this is not new. This is not an October 7th news. This is something that has been the case since the very beginning and the establishment of the State of Israel, that is an ethnostate for the Jewish people only. And sadly, the reality that we have today is the execution of that plan so bluntly in front of the world by genociding the Palestinians, and trying to push them out of Gaza as much as possible.
And how are those people, when they are shunted into these concentration camps, going to get food, water, sanitation?
They're not, in reality, obviously, the Israeli government does not care. So what we're talking about, the fact that people are dying, not just from being sniped or bombed, they're actually dying out of hunger, of starvation. And using starvation as a weapon of war has been very well established by a lot of the international organizations that operate in Gaza. So again, this is not news, but the extent and the scale of this happening over the last few weeks, pretty much since the beginning of March, has been escalating. And the fact that this is continuing to be the case by starving the people of Gaza, but at the same time, like pretending that you're giving them aid by doing all these airdrops where people are smashed under them, it is really telling us the story. So, it's in answer to your question, there's not really enough food in Gaza. There's no clean water or sanitation. You're talking about thousands and thousands of people squeezed into smaller and smaller areas, declared as safe zones where they are in fact not. We know that all those food distribution sites were declared as, safe places, and we all know that they're not because people are sniped and killed. We are talking about a catastrophe that has been unfolding in front of our own eyes for the last few months, and a lot more so and a lot more extreme in the last few weeks. And this is what we're hearing from our partners. I mean, our partners are telling us that this time they don't feel that they can survive, that this is really like when they finish with us, they are saying their goodbyes really, really sadly. So I think we're becoming so numb to this. So a lot of us, especially people who are in regular contact with people of Gaza, feel that we live in a parallel world. This is 2025, and we are actually witnessing, again, genocide that is being streamed through our social media, and our governments here are doing nothing to really stop it or to take serious action to really stop it.
Well, when you look at the West Bank, surely the situation there must be getting worse and worse as more and more of the land is taken by the settlers? And what's the food situation there and the supply of water? Because I know that Israel controls most of the water. Do they also control the food that the people are able to get in the West Bank?
The West Bank is not as bad as Gaza from a food security perspective. It is still quite bad. And I also stress that growing up, going to Palestine on a regular basis, to the West Bank in particular, you were talking about agricultural industry was very strong. In fact, West Bank used to export a lot of their produce to neighboring countries, including Jordan, even some of the Gulf states. Where I grew up in Jenin, our watermelon used to be considered the best in the world. Today, there's no watermelon grown in the West Bank or in Jenin at all because Israel has been taking the water from the ground, and up to 80-85% of the in-ground water is actually serving the settlements. The settlements are not just there to steal land and take the hilltops and encircle Palestinians. It's actually there also to take the resources, including water, and also kill industries, including the agricultural industries, because obviously there's no water, there's no agriculture. There's been a lot more strangulation of these industries in the West Bank, and yet there's some, obviously, farmers and some, it's a very expensive, obviously, proposition for a lot of those farmers, but still they are able to survive to an extent. And this is actually, again, like the size of the industry has shrunk significantly over the years. But from a food security perspective, we're still in a better shape in the West Bank compared to Gaza. Water security is a challenge. So this is, again, you know, not really great in the West Bank. Again, not nowhere near as bad as the situation in Gaza, which is, you know, obviously facing a total genocide. What the issue is in the West Bank, though, is this ongoing land theft, ongoing settler violence that has been sanctioned by the Israeli government. So settlers can roam free, do whatever they like, kill Palestinians in daylight, and face no consequences whatsoever. No Other Land, one of the contributors to the film that won the Oscar, has been shot dead only a couple of months ago. We're talking on daily basis facing settler violence in the West Bank. The government of Israel is talking about annexing the West Bank now, so bluntly, and, you know, basically saying to Palestinians, you will be encirculated by all these settlements, and this is our Judea and Samaria. Like, this is not something that will ever form a Palestinian state. So we are talking about an ongoing discourse of a very racist government that is bluntly saying that they want to take as much of Palestine, historical Palestine, as possible, get rid of the Palestinians. And again, like, you know, so bluntly saying that we're going to kick a lot of those Palestinians, including from the West Bank, to other Arab states. You are Arabs, you can go somewhere else, which obviously nothing is further from the truth. Palestinians have been deeply rooted in this land, and they will never leave if they were ever left to, obviously, their devices, as opposed to what's happening in Gaza and facing a genocide and really a question of survival.
Well, the vast majority of the Western countries have stood by while all this is happening, and also the bombing of Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Yemen, and now the flotilla ships. But it's getting a bit closer to home now, isn't it, when they've bombed the buildings in Qatar, where a great friend of the United States, a huge American base there. Is the tide turning?
I think the tide has been turning, yes. So I guess we don't, it's, you know, not all doom and gloom. And really the work of changing the tide is predominantly done by Israel itself. The fact that it's conducting acts like that, where they're bombing nearly every country in the Middle East without facing any consequences, thinking they can get away with anything they'd like to do, is really telling. So the fact that they bombed Doha, like you said, an ally of the US, you know, the place where, you know, negotiating with interlocutors and really killing them. So really that says a lot about how genuine is Israel being about negotiating a ceasefire and releasing the hostages, let alone, like, you know, obviously being genuine at all with the Palestinians, with, you know, the forever negotiations in the peace process. So this is really telling about the intentions of the Israeli government. But it is definitely changing the tide. And again, like, they killed, obviously, the prime minister of Yemen. They've attacked the flotilla in Tunisia's international waters. Total impunity. And again, the West seems to be accepting a lot of those acts without really taking serious actions, although some Western countries are starting to take more serious action, like Spain with, you know, the military sanctions, and maybe Ireland with boycotting the settlements. But we need to do a lot more. We need to sanction the Israeli government. We need to kick out the ambassador of Israel. Israel needs to, like, face diplomatic and economic and military sanctions more clearly from the Western government if you truly want to end the genocide and you truly want to ensure that the international rules-based order is actually intact. Because this is really what is at stake, Jan. It truly is that rule-based order and the international legal system that is totally collapsed. So the idea that the West morals of human rights and democracy begs to question, why is there unrelenting support for Israel as it goes more rogue and is committing genocide in broad daylight? What is the West going to do about that? Are we going to move from all that rhetoric and condemnation and with no implications into sanctions, arms, like, well, you know, obviously arms sales continue and ambassadors here? You really need to wonder if this is something serious. But it's a tide turning. Of course it is, because there's a huge disconnect between the public, those in the streets that you talk to, and those in government that are not taking any action. Those in the streets are growing by the day, and there are, you know, obviously the views of a lot of people on the ground is very clearly anti-Israel and a pro-Palestine. So yes, the tide is turning, but it has taken a lot of bloodshed.
Well, it has to take the United States with it, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, if you think about the way a lot of those Western countries operate, foreign policy is really ultimately being controlled by the USA. I mean, if there's been more attempts by trying to create a little bit more independent, like-minded, I think is the term that Albanese's government used to really try and come up with, like, maybe an alternative action on this war. But this is not really good enough. Again, this is very tokenistic. It really stops at words. It does not really include any tangible action. Again, like, you know, the one thing that we can do today is sanctioning this Israeli government. It needs to be done as soon as possible. But you are absolutely right. If the US vetoes any action from a lot of those Western countries and controls how far they can go in taking action, then we're always going to be very limited in how far we can actually go.
Well, finally, I mean, to stop using that word war, because it's not a war.
It is absolutely not a war. It is a genocide, and it is sadly, like, the wording is interesting because we've seen a lot of, like, obviously Western media and mainstream media continue to use words and terminologies in spite of the fact that this is very well established genocide by scholars. They are telling us that this is genocide. For example, every time they refer to Benjamin Netanyahu, they say the Israeli prime minister, as opposed to really saying this is a war criminal that is actually fugitive from the ICC. The ICC have, you know, obviously all Western countries should really, like, that are signatory to the ICC, should take every action to put Netanyahu and his war ministers through the ICC to be investigated for crimes. This is the thing, like, the inherent issues here as well, Jan, which is sadly happens quite often, is that the Western news organizations, they cannot cover Palestine because they're not allowed to acknowledge a very central issue here. The racist nature of Zionism and the Israeli state is really, in the most part, is to subjugate the dispossessed Palestinians. And this is not new. This is not an October 7th thing. This is 100 years of dispossessing the Palestinians. And unless we understand what is the core issue here and ensuring that we really think about protecting the human rights of Palestinians, we're not going to go anywhere. And this is becoming, especially with this collapse of the world rules-based order, Palestine becomes a litmus test. It's really the issue that frees all of us, not just Palestinians, because if we're unable to really tackle Palestine and we face consequences, if we really want to use the right terminology, then it really begs the question, are we really living in free societies that really advocate for human rights and democracies and freedom for all? This really begs that question, because they probably come for Palestinians today, but they will come for everybody else tomorrow. So really, freeing Palestine frees all of us. And this is really something very important for all your listeners to keep in mind as we really think deeply about what's happening right now and the complicity of the West and our governments in what's happening today in Palestine.
Thank you, Amin.
Thank you very much, Jan. I appreciate the time.
Amin Abbas is a Palestinian activist now living in Australia, co-founder of Olive Kids, an Australian charity to help the kids of Gaza.
Kefias are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefia to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefias.org.au. That's kefias.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
We do not know in what operations and with what objectives US forces using Australian facilities might be used. Operations of US military units from Australian territory could involve a reduction of national control over Australia's international environments. Some of the quotes from those calling for the end of AUKUS. It wasn't always like this. Today we travel back 44 years to when an Australian Prime Minister showed some backbone, standing up to the US and displaying for all to see a slither of what independence can look like. And to take us back, I'm speaking with Richard Tanter, who together with Vince Scaratura wrote two articles for Pearls and Orientations, titled When Australia Defied US Military Forces. And Richard Tanter is Senior Research Associate at the Nautilus Institute and as author and co-author with Desmond Bull and Bill Robinson, a series of major studies of the Joint Defence Facility at Pine Gap, including most recently, Does Pine Gap Place Australia at Risk of Complicity in Genocide in Gaza? Richard, can you take us back to that period, the late 70s, early 80s? What was going on in the world of politics and Australian sovereignty, which led to what you call the high water mark for Australian sovereignty over US nuclear capable bomber operations?
Well, extraordinarily of all, it was Malcolm Fraser, leader of the Liberal National Country Party coalition in the early 1980s. He was at the time very concerned about the Soviet Union, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in particular. The Americans were obviously very concerned about that. There was the time of the Iranian Revolution. There was a lot of tension in the air, and it was a very hostile parliament. Fraser had been offering the Americans bases in Australia if they wanted to. He was in favour of that. He was offering a naval base at Perth, at Stirling, but they didn't really want that. What they wanted was something completely different. And I think it at first the Fraser government said, well, maybe yes. And then they started to think much more seriously. The Americans wanted two things. They wanted the right to have B-52 bombers flying from Guam, from Anderson Air Force Base, over the Pacific, up to the Torres Strait Islands, and then down the North Queensland coast. And in particular, they wanted what they called low-level navigation flights. The Fraser government said yes to that in early 1980, and they started two or three times a month from there. This wasn't, in fact, just low-level navigation. In other words, how to get from A to B. They knew how to do that. What they really wanted and what they really called it in American military jargon was terrain avoidance flying, terrain avoidance training. And that involved them flying over North Queensland, down the Dividing Range, at about 100 metres or 150 metres above the ground. But the ground was going up and down all the time in mountainous terrain. And this was later repeated in Western Australia and in the Northern Territory. Fraser initially said yes to that. But then the Americans were asking for much more. Firstly, they were asking, could we have staging operations for these bombers out of Darwin? And secondly, we also want to have another set of B-52s flying out of Darwin right over the Indian Ocean, past Diego Garcia, all the way over to the coast of Yemen and Africa and the Gulf of Aden in particular. And that was aimed particularly at surveillance of Soviet naval forces. The Fraser government took a long time. Once they'd made the initial agreement, yes, you can fly over to us, but we want to keep talking. And through 1980, cabinet papers show that the Fraser government took a long time to sort out its position about it. And in particular, well, it actually came to a sort of clear position fairly quickly. And then it took a long time to get the Americans to agree. And this was for two principal reasons. Firstly, the Fraser government said, yes, we are willing to cooperate by having B-52 bombers flying over Queensland. Yes, we're willing to let them stage through Darwin, subject to a certain conditions about how many and so forth. But the condition is they will not carry nuclear weapons and that they will be unarmed. Now, that was a big, almost a deal breaker from the American side, because this was the age, and well, through the, anyone who lived through the early 1970s will recall the B-52 bombers that were destroying South Vietnam and much of North Vietnam and the rest of Indochina in terrible conventional bombing, which was very destructive. But the Americans wanted something different. They wanted to return the B-52s to its older project of strategic nuclear penetration flights. And what this really turned out to mean was low-level flights aimed at the Soviet Union, aimed at China, flying at very low levels to avoid modern air defences. And to do that, they needed to practice, seriously practice, this very difficult task of flying at night or on instruments only, over very rugged terrain at, 700 kilometres an hour, about 100 metres or so above the terrain and going up and down. So that was clearly very dangerous stuff. And for the Americans, it was important because they couldn't do it anywhere else outside the United States. They had a small range in Korea, but as you look at the map of Korea, the South Korean terrain is pretty mountainous, but it's very brief. They tried to get the Philippines government to agree. They tried to get the newly elected Somare government in Papua New Guinea to agree. And they pushed the Japanese. It was only Australia was their only option. So they pushed quite hard, but Fraser insisted they be unarmed and not carry nuclear weapons. And moreover, he insisted on the public, or the whole cabinet did, but it was Fraser's initiative. He demanded that Australia be allowed to say this publicly, the government could say this in Parliament, and then the Americans would concede that this was true. Now, why is this important? Well, firstly, Fraser made sure there were no nuclear weapons coming into Australia. That's really important today. Secondly, he made it clear that this was an issue of sovereignty. We will collaborate with the United States up to a certain point and no further point. And he particularly insisted on the Americans acknowledging what they really, really did not want to do, which is to say, yes, the bombers coming into Australia will not carry nuclear weapons, they will not be armed, because this was the only country in the world where the Americans agreed to that in violation to what was called their neither confirm nor deny policy. When they flew these B-52s in Japan, which they did all the time with nuclear weapons at the time, and when they flew them into Britain, or when they flew them over countries like NATO countries like Denmark or into Spain, they refused to either confirm or deny if they were carrying nuclear weapons. And of course, that's really, really disastrous for public understanding of what was going on. So Fraser stuck out like a sore thumb.
What was the reaction from the United States?
Publicly, they agreed, and the embassy made a comment approved by the State Department about 2 weeks after Fraser introduced this into Parliament. And then he read that statement of agreement into the parliamentary record. But we know, in fact, from the classified documents the Nautilus Institute got from the United States, in particular, declassified secret histories, what are called command histories. So every major command in the American military, writes an annual history. And often it's just administrative junk, or we did this, we did that. But in the case of Pacific Command, we had Nautilus had more than 10 years of these declassified histories pulled out first through Nautilus applications for Freedom of Information Act some years ago now. And they make very clear that the Americans were not happy about this. And the American military said, well, can't we change our mind? Can't we renegotiate the position? The American State Department, talking to the embassy, said, look, it is simply not possible. This is not renegotiable. We will have to live with this. And so they did. But the point was, in Japan, where B-52s were coming into Okinawa, and it was open secret that they were carrying nuclear weapons, as were American naval ships coming into Japanese harbours, there was real anger about it in the Japanese government. Why are we carrying the burden of lying for you when you let the Australians get away with this? So it was a unique event. Fraser was, well, he didn't do it alone, but he was a very important part of that story. And we need to revisit that, of course, with the prospect of nuclear weapons coming back into Australia through the B-52s, nuclear-capable B-52s, being deployed to Tyndall.
Yes, over 40 years later.
Over 40 years later. This is an extraordinary story. And it's very interesting to see that in those days, even, I don't know whether you're of an age you remember all these characters, but I remember the defence minister of the time, a man called Jim Killen, who looked like, you know, a kind of parody of a proper military officer with an Air Force, you know, World War II Air Force moustache. But he and the defence committee, where defence committee is made up of the chiefs of the services, took very seriously two issues which are relevant today. One was the issue of sovereignty. And they said, look, you need to be very clear about this. If you're going to have any kind of basing arrangement with the United States, you're giving up a certain amount of sovereignty, and you need to work out how far you're prepared to go and where you will not go. And they were very clear about that. The second thing is that they recognise the dangers of any kind of entry of nuclear weapons into Australia. They were very clear about this. And it's interesting that the military and the defence establishment in those days was really fairly sensible about an issue. And remember, this was a time at the beginning of what we call the Second Cold War, which became a very difficult and tense time. And so issues of sovereignty, which now, I mean, I've heard our defence minister talking about our sovereign partnership with the United States, as if that's not a contradiction in terms. And I think it's worth remembering that one of the aspects of Fraser, who was, of course, a very hard-nosed politician, anyone who lived through the Whitlam dismissal will remember very clearly how ferocious and brutal he could be in politics, in this case, stood up to the Americans. And I think the lesson today is we need to think about that. We have a government which seems to have no limits on its partnership with the United States. So it's worth looking back.
Well, you say that the military or whatever was sensible about it. Where's any sense coming into it at the moment? Not a lot, is there?
Not a lot. But I think there has been a transformation inside the Defence Department with a very different set of individuals. I think the military hierarchy in Australia is always has fairly mixed opinions, but at the moment, careers are being made out of AUKUS, careers are being made out of deployments of B-52s. Integration is the way to get ahead. And so we have a bad time there. And when you simply watch what our defence minister and our senior defence bureaucrats say, and some of the bureaucrats are highly competent and interesting people, but they have their talking points. And at the moment, it's about Australia aligning itself with the new American demands for deepened partnership and integration.
Is it not only that what you said just then, but the fact that these officers are interchanged with American officers? Is that happening as well?
There's always been backwards and forwards training, of course, but it's now happening at a much higher level. If you watch the careers, say, of, say, the directors of Australian spy agencies, if you look at some of the people who are directing, for example, parts of AUKUS, it's not just a bit of training in America, it's actually very long-term training there. I mean, for a start, we had the other way around. We had, under the Morrison government, an American retired admiral, not very recently retired, appointed as a deputy head of the Defense Department for AUKUS submarine work. So it goes in both directions. And there's very little documentation of this. And so it's like, I think it's something we need to think about very carefully.
Also, that the members of the government at the moment, very gung-ho about China and possible war?
Well, I think there are certainly particular people who, like, bought into that narrative. And this is a particularly dangerous way of thinking about things at a time when we are more than ever integrated, certainly much more than we were in the time that we were talking about, apropos Fraser or Whitlam or even the Hawke government, into American military planning. And the problem is that once you are get to a certain level of technological connection where you can't operate without what the Americans provide for you, that you use the same systems, and then if you have a cohort of defense thinkers and defense and military senior military officers who have spent their whole careers within that deepening alliance framework, then there aren't going to be too many critical questions coming up saying, well, is this really where we should be going? And that's the problem.
Well, surely a critical question is, if this scenario ever did go ahead and we went to war with China, we could virtually say goodbye to our economy very quickly if we lost our major trading partner, and the quality of life in Australia would be very different.
Well, I think losing a trading partner would be probably almost the least of our problems, to be honest. But yes, you're quite right. It does make no sense. And there are plenty of people, certainly in the business community, who understand this perfectly well. And there are some within, you know, the conservative ranks who have thought this through. But on the whole, I think the policy on the defence partnership part of things is being driven out of the Defence Department, out of the intelligence organisations. And certainly not, for example, you don't get a very clear idea that this is something where the Foreign Affairs Department has a strong hand and is really guiding these issues with caution. My impression is that really in the Labor Party, while Penny Wong is an important and interesting figure, on matters of foreign policy, in the broadest term, an alliance policy, this is a matter for the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister.
And, of course, the other consequences, it could lead to a nuclear war, maybe a local nuclear war, but what other consequences do you see?
Well, the main thing is, you know, the basic issue that you've raised in the form of the Australian integration into the Chinese economy, out of which we've done very well, that's really a kind of forerunner of a much more serious issue of how Australia is going to live in a world where it's normal that China, as it has been for thousands of years, the most important country, the most important state, and sometimes the major empire, not only in East Asia, but in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And we have a very hard time coming to terms with that. And the way you come to terms with it is not to say, oh, okay, we'll give up on the Americans and we'll go with the Chinese. Here we go. That would equally be foolish. But there is clearly a set of questions to ask. If you like, for Australia, and Australia is a complicated place, I think, what's a tolerable version for Australia of living with China, not as an imperial power, but as the major regional influence in our part of the world? And we have to think very hard about that. And I actually think that we need to look at countries that have lived close with China for a long time, like Vietnam, which is right next door to it, which has a history of close cooperation, of civilizational connection, but also at times serious conflict with China. And they've learned to take issues of both sovereignty and cooperation very seriously.
And we have to get off this AUKUS bandwagon pretty soon.
Yeah, I think AUKUS is really another name for the latest stage of a decade of very active American restructuring of its alliance relationships. One part of it is they now are allowing Australia to be a partner, quote unquote. What that really is about burden sharing, Australia paying for these submarines, for example, Australia agreeing for American submarines to be based in Australia, and a much more complete integration of Australian Defence Forces, in this case, our submarine force, essentially into being an extension of the Americans, almost literally. And there are people in Congress saying, well, the only condition on which we'll allow the Virginia-class submarines to be sold, they'll be second-hand, they'll be sold to Australia, is if the Australians agree formally or informally that if push comes to shove, they will be subject to American command. And that means China.
More and more voices here in Australia who are talking about the concerns that they have about AUKUS, and you'll be talking about that at Trades Hall on Sunday. You've got a wide range of people on the platform?
Yes, there is. There are trade union speakers. There's a speaker from the Greens, Tim Reid. Some remarkable people speaking, like Emma Shortis from the Australia Institute, who wrote a superb book on the American alliance a couple of years ago, and very articulate and very clear. And Margie Beavis, my colleague from ICAN and longtime nuclear campaigner. And so I think it's going to be a really a remarkable set of speakers.
And when you think of Malcolm Fraser, you wouldn't think that we'd be talking about an interview now lauding the actions of Malcolm Fraser all those years ago.
I think you and I are showing our age here. But it's right. I mean, I knew Fraser. I worked with him very closely on the book that became Dangerous Allies. He made me think about a whole lot of issues. And so I'm absolutely clear that if Malcolm was still alive, he'd be speaking at that meeting, absolutely.
Okay, I'll give the details. Thanks, Richard.
Bye-bye.
And I've been speaking with Professor Richard Tanter. And the details of the meeting next Sunday, it's a public forum. Cancel AUKUS, no war for peace and independence in our region. AUKUS and the US alliance pose a threat of war with China. What alternatives are there for Australia's peace, security and independence in a global climate of big powers, military build-up and growing tensions? And the place is Victorian Trades Hall, corner Ligon and Victoria Streets in Carlton, on Sunday, the 21st of September at 2:30.
Public Forum. Cancel AUKUS, no war. Sunday, the 21st of September at 2:30 p.m. at the Victorian Trades Hall. AUKUS threatens our security, peace and independence. It is turning Australia into a major US military base and launching pad for US-led war in the region. The Australian government is spending more than $368 billion over the next 30 years on AUKUS submarines, instead of funding social services, climate action, and sovereign manufacturing industries and long-term jobs. What alternatives are there in a global climate of big powers, military build-up, and growing tensions? Come to the forum. Cancel AUKUS, no war. 21st September, 2:30 p.m. at Victorian Trades Hall to hear more about AUKUS and how we can organise to stop it. The event will also be live streamed via the Facebook page No AUKUS Coalition Victoria, a 3CR supporter.
The Four Corners program of the 8th of September was titled Race to the Bottom, an investigation of the battle over who controls the oceans. Between companies aiming to make millions, billions, if not trillions, if they can successfully mine the deep seas of the world. Or the United Nations Seabed Authority, on behalf of the nations of the world, to protect the areas from probable catastrophic damage. This is a topic we've covered on Tuesday Home Time for many years, in fact since 2011, with members of the Deep Sea Mining Campaign here in Australia. and the Deep Sea Mining Campaign was indeed founded in 2011, dedicated to protecting the oceans from the harmful impacts of deep sea mining, and advocates for a moratorium on this destructive practice. And following the program, I spoke with Dr. Helen Rosenbaum from the Deep Sea Mining Campaign. Helen, I spoke to you before the program and you were a bit apprehensive about the way that the Four Corners team were going to present this program on deep sea mining. But once you'd seen it, you were pretty happy with the outcome. But I'd like to first acknowledge the contribution that you played into the program.
Yes, well, one of the reasons I was apprehensive is that actually with ABC Radio National, which I would have expected a lot more from, there's been a few programs over the last few years that have given Gerard Barron a lot of airtime uncritically without scope for someone being able to counter the points he was raising, which are basically just public relations nonsense, I could say, in terms of science. And also some of the promotion that I saw, just photography for the Four Corners program in advance, seemed to showcase Gerard Barron. And I thought that, my goodness, they're using him as a poster boy. In a way, I think they did, but they used it as, I think in the end, you know, the way the program played out, he became a poster boy for greed and self-interest more than anything else.
Well, just that comparison too with Elon Musk, would you like to talk about that a bit more?
Oh, well, I think it's really interesting. I'm not sure if Gerard's actually promoted that himself. I don't follow his social media. It would just give me too much of a headache, I think. But I know this has taken off in Europe. I even did an interview with a French journalist recently who told me that this comparison with Elon Musk is really a popular one in France. For me, the comparison, you know, I can see some similarities, but they're probably not the ones that Gerard Barron would like people to see. What I see is someone who's quite comfortable to interfere with political process. Elon Musk has done that with elections in Germany quite recently. Gerard Barron has done that with the process of the development of regulations by the International Seabed Authority, which is a democratic process as well, involving 168 member countries of the United Nations. I see that as one similarity, and the interference of those processes. I'm not quite sure in Elon Musk's case, but in Gerard Barron's case, it's about pure self-interest in making profit personally. I don't believe he really cares too much whether this company is going to sink or swim. He didn't care too much about that in relation to his previous company, Nautilus, in Papua New Guinea. He left that company quite wealthy because he got out at the right time before it became bankrupt. I think he's just doing the same thing again out of pure self-interest here. The way he set up this company and the shares that he's holding, if those share prices rise, he'll end up very wealthy. He and his wife, both employed by the metals company, and they're paying themselves outrageously high salaries. They have got nothing to lose at all. So I see that kind of greed and self-interest and profit very similar to Elon Musk as well.
I would have liked that issue of his previous companies to have been brought up, not right at the last sort of couple minutes of the program, but it's not just Nautilus. It's what happened to the PNG government over this and the money they lost. And then there was, of course, there was the Deep Green company as well.
Gerard Barron downplayed his role in Nautilus in the Four Corners program, saying that, oh, look, you know, I was just a seed funder and, you know, I pulled out at this time. And he did pull out quite a number of years before the company did go bust. But he wasn't just a seed funder. He wasn't just someone who stuck money in the company and then just sat back. He spent his life, because I know, because we, you know, tracked him because we were working on the Solwara 1 mine project that Nautilus was behind, he spent his life going from convention to convention, meeting with investors and leaders and really drumming up the share price. And he did that successfully because he's a very cunning marketer. So when the price was right, he left. And he left very wealthy. And as we document in one of our reports called Why the Rush, Deep Sea Mining in the Pacific, we kind of documented that he turned something like $230,000 investment in Nautilus into a $31 million gain when he left. He's a pretty smart operator. But even before Nautilus, he's had businesses that went bankrupt, businesses that had issues raised around them because of irregular sort of trading practices. So he's got form. When he left Nautilus, he brought some of the other key Australian investors in Nautilus with him to form Deep Green. Deep Green didn't go bankrupt, did a reverse merger with another company through a loophole in the US that allowed this the company, the metals company, to be established with a minimum of regulatory process. So there's a kind of pathway in the United States that I think has been altered now because too many shonky companies have set up this way. And it was developed to allow startup companies to establish without too many regulatory hurdles to encourage business. It probably did successfully encourage some business, but it also encouraged quite a lot of nefarious kind of deals going on too.
Looking at the impact of the ocean floor itself, and one issue that was brought up were the plumes. Can you talk about what those plumes are and what you believe they will do to the oceans?
Well, I think the show itself had some really nice graphics. I wouldn't mind grabbing them, actually, of showing how the two sets of plumes would form. One set of four plumes are generated as this huge mining machine moves over the floor of the ocean, scooping up nodules. These machines would be like the kind of scale that terrestrial mining machines are. They're enormous, if anyone's ever seen them. The height of a two-story house and weigh many tons. That's soft mud down there. So they're both compacting the mud, and as they scoop up the nodules, they're causing like a huge dust storm down there. The other set of plumes occurs when the wastewater from a first wash on board the vessel that the rocks, the nodules are piped up to, is discharged overboard. So that would be metal laden with metal and also potentially radioactive particles. In both plumes would have dissolved metals and potentially alpha radioactive particles, which are associated with nodules. In the program, showed really nicely these two sets of plumes. I was a little disappointed that they allowed Gerard to get away with just saying that our tests have shown that 90% of the sediment falls within a few metres of the mining operation. It's true that it's only 2 to 5% of the sediment that rises above and can get caught by currents and can travel further. But that 2 to 5% will be very significant over the life of a mining operation. These mining operation licenses, through the International Seabed Authority in any case, will go for at least 30 years and perhaps there'll be extensions. You think of that 2 to 5% that will be generated over a 30-year lifetime and 24 hours a day. You know, that's quite significant. So that's an amount of sediment that will float up into the ocean and be carried quite a lot further. It could be hundreds of thousands of kilometres. But even that sediment down at the bottom, no mining operation is only going to have one vehicle. It's going to have several going at the same time. So even if the heavy sediment falls within a couple hundred metres of the operation, that's still going to be really significant because those vehicles are moving over vast distances. Over the life of a mine, we're talking like 1,000 square kilometres, you know, will be disrupted by each mining vehicle. And what Gerard's proposing is only one of 18 exploration licences currently in the International Seabed Authority. So he's been the most aggressive and persistent, because of his own financial priorities, of all the license exploration license holders in the Pacific Ocean. But there are another 17 license holders sitting back and watching what's happening. So if you imagine that all of them may turn their exploration licenses into mining licenses, you can say goodbye to the floor of the Pacific Ocean, really.
And that was a part of the program too, that they allowed the Pacific Islanders to speak for themselves.
Yes, that's right. They had two Pacific Islanders, one a colleague from Tonga, who's a respected educator over there, the president of Palau, who's been a really strong advocate against deep sea mining, because he actually sees really clearly the nonsense of it, that, as he said in the program, we don't need these minerals from the sea. We can get them from other sources on land where we can monitor them, and also from our waste streams of metals on land, you know, re-mining waste dumps and also tailings. There's been work out of the US just recently showing that the US has got all the critical minerals it needs in its own tailing dumps, with new technologies and approaches for mining those tailing dumps now.
He made a big show, Barron, didn't he, of showing disasters of mines around the world, saying, well, you know, undersea mining be a lot better than that.
The thing is, there is a lot of disasters of terrestrial mines around the world, but opening up and exploiting the seabed is not going to stop those other disasters. We really do, as a society, need to control how mining is done in some of those really terrible situations, places like the Congo. It's not my area of work, but I know there are many campaigners who have focused on how to bring about an improvement to the human rights of people working in those mines and around those mines, and there's environmental impacts there. And that's what we've got to strengthen as a global society, ensure that those mines produce minerals responsibly, probably increase the price of metals. But that's what we need to do with all sorts of things. We need to internalise the costs of production, the social costs and the environmental costs, into the cost of production. Actually, in doing that, if metals were more expensive, I bet we'd get really serious as a society about recycling them, rather than digging new holes in the ground and exploiting new sources of pristine environments.
What other areas do you think he got away with on the program that you would have liked to have been pushed to the forefront?
I think they left it to the viewers to make up their own mind. Gerard, near the end of the program, made a statement about how beneficial deep sea mining was going to be to the economies of Pacific Island states. And he just pulled some figure out of the air that he thought they would be earning in hundreds of billions of dollars. I can't even remember, but the figure was ludicrous. All of that is based on speculation. There's a vast difference. And one of the people they interviewed, actually, from Iceberg Research, we've been raising this in our own work for ages and encouraging other researchers to look at the difference between what the metals company files with the United States Security Commission and what they actually say in their public relations. There's a vast difference between the risks they identify there. And if you look at their filings, it's really clear, as clearly listed as a risk, that they actually don't know what the value of the ores are down there, if you call them ores, the polymetallic nodules, in terms of metals, because the sampling they've done has only been quite small. They don't know the density over all of the area that they want to mine and whether that's going to be economic. They don't know whether the technology is going to work at all, whether it's going to hold up. And the fact if it fails down there also has environmental implications, of course, because there'll be leakage of all sorts of things and further damage to the environment. So there's all these unknowns that we constantly raise. And this iceberg researcher, that's the name of the consultancy, raised this on the program as well. So it's entirely speculative, you know, if there is going to be any financial advantage to states like Tonga and Nauru that have signed contracts with the metals company. And what we know anyway from the contract with Tonga is it is entirely in the favour of the metals company. There are so many clauses in that contract that put Tonga in the firing line for any failures. And it's not just this generation of Tongans right now. The contract encompasses generations to come in that its implications are multi-generational. It's for decades into the future. As rightly pointed out by Dr. Angataya Kata in the program, it will affect the future of Tonga and Tongans, not only in terms of destruction, potential destruction of the ocean, which is their, they see as their life, but also in terms of financial liabilities.
What about the role of the ISA in the program?
That was extremely interesting. I think because of what the metals company is doing in trying to bypass the International Seabed Authority and go through the United States now, it's really provoked a negative response from both the Secretary General of the ISA and many countries who before were kind of more or less, you know, undecided on the issue. There are now 39 countries that call for a moratorium on deep sea mining. A couple more were added through this last ISA meeting. Letitia Carvalho, the Secretary General, she was just elected late last year. We finally got rid of Gerard Barron's old pal, Michael Lodge. And I have no doubt that this is one of the reasons that Gerard has gone through President Trump, a fellow rogue, rather than trying to work through the ISA process. Because Letitia Carvalho, she's an oceanographer, she respects science, values the deep ocean, and she's very cognizant of the fact that the ISA has got this double mandate. It's quite a unworkable double mandate in a way, but it's a mandate to both protect the deep ocean and to regulate the exploitation of its resources in a way that benefits all of humanity. I think what came out really strongly in the program is that the Secretary General, I think it strengthened her resolve probably to bring into the foreground the mandate to protect deep sea and to only go ahead with deep sea mining once we understand what the impacts are. And perhaps I need to watch the program again, but I believe she implied that, you know, there could be a decision not to go ahead with it should science show the impacts are too great.
Can Barron bypass the ISA and go straight to the US? What are the implications for the ISA, which is a United Nations body?
Well, he's already gone straight to the US. Barron is a mastermind. He's an evil mastermind, but he's brilliant in strategy for his own gain. He was lobbying the US under Biden's administration for years to try and fast-track the deep sea mining through them. The Biden administration weren't sympathetic, but he kind of hedged his bets, and for quite a few years he's been developing relationships with the Republicans. And so when Trump came to power, he had key people that he had already developed relationships with in key positions now under Trump. And they were all for it. I mean, you've got President Trump, you know, dig baby dig. They're like-minded. And he really played well, and still is. He's playing well this fear-mongering card of, you know, well, China is going to dominate our resources and we're going to be at the beck and call of China, and this is a national security issue now. And it fitted so well with Trump's own narrative. There's a meeting of, you know, minds there. They're kind of extraction bros, really, those two and the administration. Pretty much single-handedly, I would say, he manipulated things over there to the point where a few months ago now, Trump issued an executive order to fast-track deep-sea mining for the US. It's a little unclear what he plans to do in international waters on this, but certainly on national waters, they're fast-tracking it. There's already been hearings, Senate committee hearings, and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Organization, NOAA, has been kind of reassigned its tasks. It's no longer monitoring climate change and environmental aspects of oceanography. It's all about now fast-tracking projects like this. That is actually happening, and they're looking at issuing licenses within the US territorial waters. But what Jared is more interested in is using the US to pursue its own licenses that already holds in the Pacific Ocean, in the international waters. There's an antiquated old sort of 40-year-old bit of US legislation that no one had heard of until he had done this, that Jared Barron is hoping to use to gain US support for going for his Nauru license and the Pacific Ocean and the Tongan license. And no one knows what will happen, how this is going to play out, whether Trump will really take on the International Seabed Authority and the 168 member nations. And this is what in the program Leticia Carvalho, the Secretary General, referred to in terms of the US's unilateral action here. She's actually instituted an inquiry into the metals company to see whether they've breached United Nations regulations under the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea. And if they have, she will have the power, or the ISA will have the power, to revoke the metals company's licenses in the Pacific Ocean. If we're all in a sensible law-abiding society, that would mean that would be the end of the metals company's aspirations in the Pacific Ocean. But who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? Are they just going to send machines down there regardless anyway?
Well, it won't be the first time that Trump's thumped his nose at a UN body, will it?
No, which is very worrying. And all we can hope is the technology's not there. It's still many years off. All we can hope is that Trump will disappear. We'll have a Democrat government reigning some sense in the US and hopefully revoking or, you know, walking back from the processes that were set up under Trump and the executive order to fast-track deep-sea mining. But who knows? Perhaps a Democrat government will still go with this. Perhaps Trump will change the rules over there so he can run for his extra term of government.
Oh, well, I don't know how to finish off with that comment.
Well, it's a very uncertain world. And I think, you know, for our own part, we've been trying to at least get our own government here in Australia to back a moratorium. And this is something that Sarangel Whips, the president of Palau, raised in the program, the Four Corners program, that when asked what he would like to say to Canberra, he said that Australia's in the Pacific. We're kind of on the edge of the Pacific, and we should support the Pacific Island nations in supporting a moratorium against deep sea mining.
You hope that this comes up at the forum meeting and that well, they were tackled.
We hope that Sarangal Whips has a meeting with Albanese.
Yes.
At that meeting. But, you know, I understand also, to be realistic, it's a very fraught situation for our government because there are three Pacific Island countries who are pursuing deep sea mining. Cook Islands is pursuing that rather aggressively in their own territorial waters, but they do have a contract with a Belgian company for the Pacific Ocean. That Belgian company has had the good sense to just put everything on hold for now in international waters while the regulations are being developed, which is a stark contrast to Gerard Barron, right, who is interested in deep sea mining but actually wants to be a good corporate citizen, is just waiting to see how things play out. A huge contrast to the desperation shown by the metals company in trying to push ahead before they do go bankrupt.
Want to know what happened at the 2024 People's Blockade of the World's Largest Coal Port?
Come along to a special 3CR screening of Turning the Ship, the short film that explains all, and be inspired to join the blockade this year.
Revisit the epic event and hear how this incredible people-powered protestival came together.
Join us on Friday, 19th September at Evil Thoughts in East Brunswick.
Head to Rising Tide Victoria Insta or Facebook page to RSVP and to get all the details.
Rising Tide Victoria is a 3CR supporter.
The 90s had a car that ran electric, they held back the tech. Shit, now it's gotten hectic, they can't...
Earlier this month, 4 out of 5 justices of the Brazilian Supreme Court panel voted to convict former President Jair Bolsonaro on all 5 counts in a landmark decision and sentence him to 27 years and 3 months in jail. For an assessment of the consequences of the judgment, I spoke with activist, author and journalist Fred Frente. And my first question to Fred was, were there any doubts along the way that this case would ever get to court, let alone the decision we now have?
If we talk about the evidence itself, I think the evidence was extremely overwhelming. We're talking about events that were very similar to what we saw with the Capitol Hill riots when Trump refused to accept his defeat back in 2000. We saw similar events basically in Brasilia, in the capital of Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro supporters, clearly directed by him and those around him, tried to take over the Supreme Court of Justice, the Parliament, Presidential Palace, in an attempt to prevent Lula da Silva from assuming the presidency. So I think the fact that there was a very clearly an attempt to overturn a democratic election, very clearly an attempt to install an unelected person as president, the evidence was pretty overwhelming. Then, of course, is the question of the court system itself in Brazil, a court system that's traditionally been quite dominated by the right wing. I mean, we should remember that this is the same judicial system that also jailed Lula in the previous elections to the last. So we're talking about the 2018 elections. In the lead up to those elections, jailed him under trumped up charges of corruption that were later proven to be untrue and hence why he was released from jail. But the fact that that court had found him guilty in the first place prevented him from being able to run for the presidency, and then actually which facilitated Jair Bolsonaro's election back in 2018. So it was always going to be a difficult process, but I think the fact that there was overwhelming evidence, plus a generalized overwhelming sentiment in Brazilian society in support of the idea that those responsible for those events should be punished, meant that we got this result in the end, which is not to say that Jair Bolsonaro doesn't continue to have his supporters as well. They're a minority, but they're an important minority in Brazilian politics. But I think the overwhelming sentiment amongst the Brazilian people was that Bolsonaro had gone a bit too far in this regards of essentially trying to carry out a coup to stop a democratically elected president from assuming power.
They picked 5 judges from a panel. Is that significant?
The 5 judges were there from the first chamber of the Supreme Court. The final ruling was 4-1, so it was a pretty decisive ruling in terms of the various charges that Jair Bolsonaro, and in this particular case, there was, if I remember correctly, 7 other accomplices that were on trial with him. I think overall there are some 30 or so of his closest collaborators that are facing different levels of charges. In this one, Bolsonaro is facing charges of everything from incitement to a coup through to involvement in criminal organisation. And so the fact that we had that quite a decisive sort of vote by the judges, 4-1, you know, indicates as well that the fact that the evidence was pretty clearly in favour of a guilty verdict. Bolsonaro, of course, has said that he was going to appeal the verdict, so we'll now have to see how that proceeds.
It doesn't matter in a court case like this that they can, if a person wasn't in the country when the event happened, they can get round that.
I mean, one doesn't necessarily have to be in the place that a coup attempt is occurring to have been involved in the planning for the coup. And this is what the court case has shown, that this was not just simply sort of spontaneous protests that just sort of happened on a particular day and that then spiraled out of control, but that there was clear planning behind this coup plot, all the way to up to and including direct contacts with the Brazilian military high command. In fact, it was large part because the high command were not willing to go along with the coup plot that it didn't succeed. But everything else that was part of the plan really went into action. It was just that the Brazilian military high command said that they were not really willing to go against the vote of the people and participate in such a coup plot. Scenario has been shown to have been involved in all of this planning.
As you said, there were several others on trial with him. Did they get similar sentences?
Yes, I believe that all of them got, you know, not exactly the same sentences, because some of them were facing maybe only partially the same charges as Bolsonaro. But, you know, certainly all of them were also found guilty in this trial of the different charges that they were facing. And as I said, those will be appealed, and there are other court cases ongoing. But I think what it did definitely, you know, what I would say is that, you know, I think the court case, the ruling this time has very much both reflected the strong overwhelming evidence, but also restricted the strong overwhelming sentiment amongst the Brazilian people that those responsible for the coup plot should be punished.
But his supporters would, of course, not accept that. Were there many demonstrations in the hours and days after?
Well, you're right. Of course, it's not just Jair Bolsonaro who's not accepting the ruling. In fact, and it's not just his supporters in Brazil. In fact, it's some of his supporters all the way up into the White House, such as Trump and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who are refusing to accept the result, who are calling it a witch hunt, political persecution against their friend. So, of course, there's been protests during the trial of varying degrees of support. I would say that over time, the size of the protests for Bolsonaro have been declining. As I said, that's not to say that they were insignificant or tiny. They were still quite large mobilizations, but certainly for different reasons, that, you know, the sort of size has been declining over time. And I'm sure that they will continue to want to rally around Bolsonaro, both as because Bolsonaro really has played an important role in sort of cohering, you know, a new radical far right in Brazilian politics, and continues to be their sort of the figurehead. Because, of course, that's part of what's at stake here as well. It's not just bringing the coup plotters to justice. It's not just about Bolsonaro's fate, but it's in large part a bit about the fate of this new radical right that has emerged in Brazil, of which Bolsonaro is both the key figure, but also perhaps the unifying figure, one who they were expecting to be able to run as the president in the next presidential elections. But of course, if this current ruling stands, won't be able to stand for those elections. And as I said, he's a figure viewed as a close friend and ally, not just by those in the far right in Brazil, but internationally as well, all the way into Washington.
Are you saying with other Latin American countries as well?
Yes, of course. Very close friends with Milei, with Javier Milei, the president in Argentina. Even if the two do not necessarily share this, they don't necessarily come from the same kind of radical right sort of political background. They certainly share a common affinity of opposition to what they, you know, they sort of describe as war on communism, but really it's just sort of war on anything that's sort of to the left of them politically. So in the case of in Argentina, there you'd have the Peronist movement, previously led by Cristina Kirchner, who herself is facing, you know, has been facing criminal cases as well regarding corruption. So certainly not the only case. Jair Bolsonaro is not the only politician across the continent facing these kind of issues. And then, of course, in Brazil, we have Lula's Workers' Party, which is the main party in the ruling coalition in government there, back in Lula.
Well, we've already seen that Trump has put in 50% tariffs as a result of the trial. Can he make things very difficult for Lulu in the future if this appeal fails?
Well, that's certainly what they're threatening to do. They haven't as yet announced any further measures since the ruling, but have certainly made it clear that they disagree with the ruling and that they will consider further actions. So we already know that they've talked about implementing or want, you know, wanting to implement a 50% tariff on Brazilian goods. We also know that they've applied specific sanctions on the judges in the Supreme Court that were part of this ruling. In fact, they've already done that prior to the verdict. So there's no doubt those sanctions will remain now that the verdict has come down. They haven't made it clear exactly what they want, what they will do. Often with Trump, it's difficult to know exactly what he will do, how much of it is bluster, how much of it is a willingness to follow through. But we do know that definitely that Trump made it extremely clear, if we didn't know already, that he's very good friends with Bolsonaro, that he sees Bolsonaro as his representative in Brazil, and that obviously he would like to see a pro-Trump government in power in Brasilia. For that to happen, obviously would probably require, as a bare minimum, Bolsonaro being able to be the candidate for the far right, given that, as I said, he doesn't have majority support in the country, but he still has a very significant support amongst the minority of the country, and he's able to unite sort of disparate forces that perhaps under a different candidate would find themselves more divided. So strategically, for Trump, it's really important to try to see how they can get, at the very minimum, keep Bolsonaro's movement united around him and see if they can get him to a place where he's able to stand for the presidency in the elections, which are due next year, or failing that, at least be able to keep the movement united behind a consensus candidate to see if they can replace the Lula government, which, you know, has been willing to speak out against some of Trump's policies in the region. It certainly has spoken out about Trump's military deployment in the Caribbean. It's certainly spoken out about the tariffs that have been applied, not just in Brazil, but across the region. Spoken out about Trump's mass deportation programs and the treatment of migrants in the United States. So in that regards, it's no surprise then that the United States under Trump would prefer a Bolsonaro government in power.
You mentioned the elections next year. Is the appeal likely to have happened prior to that?
It's not clear, firstly, when the appeal will happen or how long. There's no, as far as I've seen on the news, unless that's changed overnight, there's no date that's been set. And then, of course, it's unclear how long how long the trial itself will last for. Of course, that's something that Bolsonaro will certainly be seeking to sort of speed up to happen and would be applying pressure on that basis to say, well, look, because the outcome of this may determine who can run in the presidential elections. That I think it's probably highly likely that it will happen or be all completed before the presidential elections in order to facilitate whether, you know, depending on the verdict, a clear decision by the Bolsonaro camp as to who their presidential candidate is.
Well, finally, Fred, when you look at the size of Latin America and you look at the size of Brazil, it's certainly a very important country. If this appeal fails, what do you believe will be the consequences of this decision to jail him?
Going to be several consequences. I think the first and probably the most important consequence, I think, is that it set a very clear signal, very clear marker. The kind of actions that we saw with the attacks in Brasilia on the government buildings in January 2022 cannot be tolerated within a democratic system. I think for me that's really the most significant. Increasingly volatile situation where we are seeing governments moving towards more authoritarian practices. The fact that an independent court under pressure from the people has made this ruling is significant. I think then, you know, what's going to be the broader significance for the elections? That's a bit hard to tell. It's hard to tell because Lula, on the one hand, has seen his support declining over the past sort of year or two. That said, it's sort of in many ways rebounded a bit as a result of Trump's attacks on Brazil and on Lula with the tariffs and speaking out around the Bolsonaro verdict or the Bolsonaro case. So how Lula's popularity will continue to track in the face of a possible increased aggression, hostility from the United States against Brazil, which of course is likely to stoke up anti-imperialist, anti-US or pro-Brazilian sentiment, will no doubt only help Lula in those elections. And then, of course, as part of the elections, we'll have to see what happens with the right. But I do think that the statement that's been made about the need to defend democracy really is the most significant one. What will happen next? I think there are various variables at play, and it's very hard to really know exactly how it would all unfold. But a very clear sort of benchmark has been set with this verdict.
Thank you so much, Fred.
No, thank you. Thank you.
And Fred Fuentes is a journalist, activist, and author focusing on Latin America.
Rathi Bartlett fled Sri Lanka with her husband and daughter to come to Australia by boat in 2013. She was denied refugee status and has lived with the threat of deportation and separation from her Australian-born second daughter since then. So in 2023, with 21 other women, she walked 640 kilometres from Melbourne to Canberra to draw attention to their plight. Come and hear her story in conversation on Sunday, September the 21st, from 3 to 5pm in Clifton Hill. Details and bookings via centreforacompassionatesociety.net. The Centre for a Compassionate Society is a 3CR supporter.
Now the second and final part of the interview with Dr. Sasha Gillies-Lukakis, looking at the history of the small Central American country of Costa Rica.
What happened essentially was in the 1940s, we saw a leader rise to prominence whose name was Rafael Angel Calderon. He was a medical doctor. He was just known as Calderon by his followers. So very well respected, very well known within Costa Rica's elite community. But he also treated a number of poor Costa Rican neighborhoods out of his own personal convictions. He ended up leading the National Republican Party, which was not explicitly socialist, but it was certainly a left-wing populist party. It had as its aim redistribution of land, which was, as we've discussed, very, very concentrated, and getting at these core issues of discrimination, removing the internal apartheid, the racial apartheid that existed, even allowing those people to vote because they weren't allowed to vote as of the 1940s, just to give you an idea of how severe that discrimination was, and of essentially trying to break down this corrupt democratic system, because it was democracy. People went out, they voted, they went through that sort of process, tradition of going out and putting in their vote, but nothing ever changed. And so in 1944, Calderon won the election by a landslide, 70% of the vote. And he did this also by aligning himself with the Popular Vanguard Party, which was the Costa Rican equivalent of the Communist Party. This was a Marxist-Leninist party that aligned very heavily with Calderon, and together they had essentially a supermajority in 1944. And they began to implement these more socially redistributive policies, tried to address the issue of land by parceling out some of the bigger estates to smaller farmers. But the most important thing was that they wanted to improve public health care and education, which they did in a very sort of limited way with the time they had, and infrastructure. This was the biggest issue in Costa Rica, and it's one of the biggest issues in Costa Rica today. The infrastructure in the country is still very, very lacking. We're talking about even basic things like roads, ports, to be able to export produce, even, you know, medical infrastructure, schools, just basic primary schools. All of this was just left abandoned for 100 years prior to this point. And we finally began to see Calderon and the Popular Vanguard Party pushing for more money and more funding. And people generally could see this. And this was exemplified because we began to see the opposition, of course, to Calderon begin to form. And this came in the figurehead leader of José Figueres Ferrer. Now, he was a businessman, again, an elite of the liberal community in San José, and he was a fierce opponent of what was called Calderonismo, Calderon ideology, which was basically left-wing populism, and in some cases being pushed in a more communist direction by his allies in the Congress. Ferrer essentially went into self-imposed exile after attempting to start an insurrection. Actually, he wasn't arrested. He went into exile before the police and the army could get to him. And he went over to a number of different Caribbean countries and to the United States. And he created what was called the Caribbean Legion, which was a number of exiles from across Latin America, chiefly from Costa Rica, but from other countries too. At first, we didn't know where the money was coming from at the time. Now we do because of declassified documents. A lot of the money was coming from the CIA, that they were funneling funds and weapons to this Caribbean Legion, which had cells across countries like Jamaica, Cuba, Dominican Republic, in the States as well. And they were training cadres for an attempted overthrow of Calderon in Costa Rica. Ferrer essentially was going to become the new head of state once this group of mercenaries essentially invaded Costa Rica, overthrew Calderon, and occupied the seat of government, the parliament in San Jose. This was the plan. Essentially, they wouldn't get to do this, to sort of implement their plan. And there were 700 members of this Caribbean Legion until 1948. Ferrer tried to implement a general strike beforehand. He called for a general strike prior to the 1948 elections. Critically, no one responded. No one in Costa Rica responded to this call for a general strike against Calderon. And this is why I said before, we have an indication that the Costa Ricans were happy with the progress that was happening under this new government, this more left-wing government, because in other countries, there generally was at least a portion of the population that could be mobilized against whatever sort of popular reform was happening. In Costa Rica, there was not a single protest against Calderon, even though Ferrer was being funneled through with all of this money and this, you know, these PR mechanisms that the CIA, of course, tried and tested in different Latin American countries. But as we mentioned, so much of the population of Costa Rica, regardless of race, was so poor and disenfranchised that they did not raise a finger against Calderon. They ignored these calls for a general strike, and they continued to support the government there.
How is Calderon getting on with his neighbours?
This is interesting. So Calderon had a complicated relationship with the other Central American leaders. Almost all of them at this point were right-wing dictators or military regimes of one flavor or another. He had a very poor relationship with Guatemala. There was very little trade happening with Guatemala and with Honduras. Very little trade happening with Panama. It was quite isolated at this stage. Calderon was seeking trade with Mexico. At this time, this was his big gambit of really trying to build up the port infrastructure, particularly on the Pacific coast, to be able to export coffee and export cacao. So still relying on this agricultural model, which unfortunately meant the economy really didn't grow that much regardless, but at least trying to modernize the port infrastructure to improve the amount of commerce that was going up to Mexico, which at this time was at least in part a little bit more independent and sovereign, you know, because this had been after the Mexican Revolution. Interestingly, he did have quite a close relationship with the Somoza family in Nicaragua. As we know, they were very close to the United States. More so out of personal affinity, Calderon had actually traveled to Nicaragua. And as I mentioned, he was quite a prominent figure as a doctor, quite a prominent personality. And I think they just personally got along. One of those very peculiar cases where leaders with quite different political and economic policies somehow see common ground, and they actually had quite a stable trading relationship. And the Somozas actually ignored the United States. Interestingly, when they were asked to apply pressure on Costa Rica's economy, they continued to trade quite consistently, which is quite interesting. Calderon was still quite an outlier, the odd country out in Central America. And, you know, unfortunately, when the pressure did come from Ferrer, from the exiles, there was no one to help them. And this did happen in 1948, where essentially very, very tight, the CIA, the Americans and the exiles pushing huge amounts of money into what was called the opposition bloc, which was a coalition of elite aligned parties who wanted to oust Calderon and oust the Popular Vanguard Party. Now, what happened was essentially there was a percentage point difference, according to the official results, a percentage point difference of 0.3%. 0.3%. This is such a sliver, you know, knife edge election. And it was in the favor of the opposition bloc. So the opposition bloc was leading by 0.3%. But what happened was there was a number of seats that remained in the hands of the Popular Vanguard, the communist bloc, that were a holdover from some by-elections. So the Calderonistas, the pro-left-wing parties, still technically had a majority to win that election, of course, relying on the Vanguard party and the communists. So what happened, of course, was Ferrer cried foul and said that this election was illegitimate. And he brought the Caribbean Legion over, which was waiting in the wings. They were waiting in Honduras, waiting in Cuba, to come down and invade the country, essentially. And Ferrer called for an armed uprising. This was done by the well-trained, you know, comparatively speaking, well-trained and well-armed Caribbean Legion, which had ballooned to over 1,000 mercenaries. And they launched a war, a civil war, against Calderon's government. So essentially what we saw in 1948 was the beginning of the Costa Rican Civil War, which lasted until 1953. This was comparatively a very bloody war. Over 2,000 people died by official estimates. Again, the number is always higher than the official estimate. And we essentially saw a war between the exiles, these mercenaries, and the Costa Rican army, which was quite poor and underfunded because, of course, Calderon was putting money into other parts of the economy and the public sector. And they also had communist militias, you know, communist groups that mobilized to defend the government. But unfortunately, it wasn't enough. You know, the exiles had CIA weapons, very, very advanced for the time and much stronger and much more capable than anything the Costa Rican army had, let alone the communist militias, who were essentially armed with machetes and pitchforks. And essentially, these mercenaries deposed the government, killed many communists and members of the armed forces. They essentially imposed Ferrer as the new president by the early 1950s. So this is one of the first examples of a sustained, you know, CIA operation to remove a left-wing government in Latin America, and they were successful. And what Ferrer did, you know, very, very clever, he abolished the armed forces, removed the armed forces from existence. To this day, Costa Rica doesn't have an army. They only have a police force. Now, what he did was he essentially recreated the police force, which was very, very minimal before this uprising, this coup, and he made the members of the Caribbean Legion the national police. So the only group in the country that had force, a monopoly on force and weapons, was the Caribbean Legion, which was now the Costa Rican police force. And they continued their persecution of the communist movement. They outlawed the Popular Vanguard Party, which was the communist party that had helped Calderon come to power. But what they did do was they maintained some of the reforms that Calderon had implemented. So they finished off a lot of the infrastructure projects. They allowed the Afro-Costa Ricans and the indigenous Costa Ricans to get the vote. They ended the racial apartheid system, which that law had already been put to the Congress by Calderon. So this was not something that Ferrer and the exiles had done. They just continued the formal process to get that approved and tried to demonstrate, you know, that they weren't completely abolishing the reforms of the Calderon years, but they were in practice, economically speaking, so where it counted, they repealed the land redistribution, which was really the crux of what were the main complaints of the poorer people in Costa Rica. But on the surface, they did make some political and social concessions. He even said, Ferrer, and he was a long-ruling leader after this, and, you know, he actually juxtaposed himself when the Cuban Revolution happened. He said, look, we are a better revolution than the Cuban Revolution. He actually said this. We've got these social reforms. We finished these infrastructure projects, but we didn't have to adopt communism and extremism like the Cubans did. So, you know, he tried unsuccessfully to position Costa Rica as this sort of social democratic alternative to socialism, which again was quite deliberate. And, you know, he, once he became president, he flooded Costa Rica with CIA operatives, and one of the largest American embassies in Central America is in Costa Rica to this day. Ferrer created what was called the National Liberation Party. So he formalised the exile movement into this political bloc. He didn't rule uninterrupted. He ruled in three distinct periods, all in all for about 15, 20 years, so a very long time. But at points, the National Liberation Party did lose elections to other centre-right parties. There was no difference virtually in the policy. But Ferrer essentially remained this figure in the shadows throughout the latter half of the 20th century. You know, once those initial infrastructure projects were finished, they stopped dedicating money to the public service and to the public sector. They didn't implement anything else, and they continued to essentially financialize the economy. This was the new model that they adopted. Instead of relying on agricultural products, which to be fair was not working in Costa Rica, they heavily leaned into these emerging financial institutions like the World Bank, the Monetary Fund, and they essentially turned Costa Rica into a financial capital center in Latin America. So they were a source, a center of money laundering in Latin America, money washing, essentially, of illegal funds that came into Costa Rican banks, and the Costa Rican banks would take a portion of that money, essentially, as a part of these illegal deals. But it was legal in Costa Rica. This was what they now based their economy on, doing what a lot of Western countries have now done, which is financializing the economy. They never created any sort of industrial base. They have essentially just turned Costa Rica into a service-based economy. Tourism, as we mentioned, tourism has become the number one foreign currency earner for Costa Rica. By far, copy sort of like the number, you know, four or five after all of the different banking and financial sectors. Tourism is the number one, you know, chiefly natural tourism and ecotourism, because as we mentioned, Costa Rica has beautiful, beautiful natural resources and natural scenery. A number of natural UNESCO biosites have been recognized as well. And this has given some incentive to the Costa Rican government, at least in the 20th century, to protect a lot of their forest for the purpose of tourism. That has changed now as we've gone into the 21st century. And I will also mention that Costa Rica is one of the most debt-ridden countries in Latin America as well, because it leaned so heavily into this mantra, this neoliberal mantra of, you know, you take the debt on and this will make your country financially competitive so that the financial sector and financial services can make your country continue to function. So it's very, very debt-ridden. Also that financial services can continue to serve as the basis of the Costa Rican economy. And we've seen that come to the point of crisis in the last 5 years, because, of course, you know, this is what countries like Argentina did in the 90s to a much more extreme degree than Costa Rica. At least the Costa Ricans made the investment of training a lot of bankers who are still neoliberal, but they at least understood that it had to be a gradual process and didn't have to be so extreme like in Argentina's case, where you had bank runs and where you had hyperinflation. At least the bankers that the Costa Rican elite hired to essentially run their government were somewhat competent, which is why we've had relative stability. We haven't had any sort of collapse yet, in spite of spiraling inequality, very, very poor conditions for people in Costa Rica. There have been a lot of social protests throughout the 21st century, but basically what we've seen happen is continued dependence on tourism. And we've essentially seen a switch between two major parties, again, the National Liberation Party, which is still run by the Ferrer family, essentially the Ferrer dynasty, and the Party for Social Democracy, which is a bit more right-wing than they are. So they're both right-wing parties. In the last election, it was this Social Democracy Party led by a banker, Rodrigo Chavez, who's a bit more of a populist, a right-wing populist. And we have seen more tension now because the debt crisis in Costa Rica has become very acute. There is now very high inflation, much higher than there's ever been. We are seeing a little bit of even capital flight from a lot of the Costa Rican banks because of how stressed the financial sector is becoming in Costa Rica. And as a result, we saw the election of this right-wing populist, Rodrigo Chavez, who has attempted to essentially push through some quite extreme austerity measures. So much like Javier Milei in Argentina, Chavez has attempted to essentially do the same thing in Costa Rica. So to completely financialize Costa Rica's economy, give banks the power to seize citizens' savings from their bank accounts, which, again, was attempted in Argentina about 25 years ago. You know, essentially a repeat of the extreme, extreme neoliberalism and foregoing any sort of fiscal conservatism. And of course, the Costa Rican elite and the National Liberation Party, which have relied on this sort of very, very managed financial sector, have come into very fierce conflict with Chavez and with the more populist measures he's trying to take. And Chavez has now taken aim, chiefly at the judiciary, which is trying to block all of these new laws he's trying to pass. And of course, the judiciary has been virtually owned by the Ferrer family for decades. So they are partisan. They are aligned with Ferrer's political party, and they're sort of aligned more with the fiscal conservatives and the banking elite, who do not quite want this really extreme measure because they know that it's going to collapse the Costa Rican economy. We have seen the coalescence of a left-wing movement in the last election in 2022, the Broad Front, Frente Amplio, like in a lot of countries in Latin America, which came fifth. So again, you know, there hasn't been a very broad-based left-wing movement. It was good to see that they still got at least some visibility and some seats in the last election, following a very similar path to those governments in Argentina, Brazil, those left-wing parties. But by and large, they managed to essentially eradicate that legacy during this period of neoliberal financialized rule. And, you know, I will just go back to the previous period in the 20th century. Costa Rica, after that coup in the 1940s, 50s, was consistently on the side of the United States. They were the United States bagman in Central America. They were one of the first countries to cut ties with Cuba after the Cuban Revolution. They supported the Contras very, very heavily, including providing asylum for Contra soldiers and politicians during the Nicaraguan Civil War and the U.S. intervention there. And they have always done the U.S.'s bidding in the United Nations. They very consistently vote with the United Nations, sorry, with the United States on U.N. resolutions, even to the point now of either supporting or not condemning Israel, one of a few Central American countries that do this. It's very sad to see that Costa Rica has been so tightly controlled for so long. People in the country, as I mentioned, it's the most unequal country in the region. Very extreme poverty in Costa Rica. And until recently, until the emergence of this Frente Amplio, there has not been any political movement to channel that anger and that frustration. And to be honest, I think it'll be many, quite a few more election cycles before the Frente Amplio or another political party on the left is able to mount any sort of challenge, because Costa Rican politics is very, very entrenched. It's very, very personality based. So if you don't have money and you can't get your personality known, you generally won't do well. A lot of people don't vote in the Costa Rican elections. They have low voter turnout because there's still a lot of illiteracy in Costa Rica. Essentially, what we see is a fight between two neoliberals, between one more extreme neoliberal who wants to use that chainsaw economic model of just cutting everything out and giving the banks total power, and those, I guess we could say, more intelligent neoliberals who want to maintain the stability of the financial sector without leading to a collapse of the economy. They have the same goal, which is continued neoliberalism, improving their own financial interests at the expense of the population. But they've essentially come to blows. You know, we've got a right-wing populist against a mainstream centre-right political movement. Look, in the future, I'm not sure what Costa Rica's trajectory will be, to be honest. As I mentioned, there have been increasing social protests in the country, but nothing with the power to challenge the status quo yet. Or I should say nothing with the vision to challenge the status quo. But I think this does go to show how critical Costa Rica was all those years ago, almost a century ago now, as one of the first places where we saw universal support for a left-wing political project, the textbook CIA coup in Latin America, that's one of the first places where it was implemented, if not the first place where it was implemented. So Costa Rica does have that legacy, but it's been forgotten. It has definitely, definitively been forgotten. It's not taught in schools in Costa Rica. There's a lot of censorship and propaganda about that time, to the point where Ferrer declared himself a national hero. And that's what school children learn in Costa Rica, that the Ferrers are heroes. It's a very, very propagandized society, and there is the dissatisfaction there. But as I said, we might need to wait and see until there is a movement that has the power to channel that and articulate it. But things happen quickly in these sorts of countries, particularly in a country like Costa Rica, which is so precarious in terms of its economic model. You know, it's so heavily dependent on the financial sector that all it will take is a bank run, or all it will take is the banks to do something extreme with, you know, the financial savings of the citizenry to potentially cause a massive uprising.
Just finally, Sasha, have drugs been transited through Costa Rica to the north?
Yes. Again, Costa Rica, this is interesting because Costa Rica itself, in terms of drug crime, it is there. It's lower compared to countries like Honduras, still lower than El Salvador, lower than Panama. Nicaragua has lower drug crime than Costa Rica, but by comparison, it is low, though there are still traffickers that use the territory. But what is important to note is that a lot of the illicit transactions around this narco trafficking pass through Costa Rican banks. That's the Costa Rican connection here, that a lot of that financing is laundered through Costa Rican banks and Costa Rican financial institutions. So this is the sort of thing I'm talking about. So, you know, on the surface, yeah, there is definitely drug trafficking in Costa Rica, and in some neighborhoods of San Jose, it's very bad. But what is really bad about Costa Rica, and what has led to narco control of a lot of politicians in the country, is that they use the banks. The banks are facilitating narco corruption through these financial transactions and money laundering. So that's where Costa Rica differs a little bit, but certainly from that perspective, Costa Rica is deeply, deeply, deeply involved in drug trafficking with the knowledge and the consent of the political elite.
And many thanks to Dr. Sasha Gillies-Likakis, and you can hear more of Sasha and friends on the Latin American Update program here on 3CR every Sunday morning at 10:30.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.